This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
It's Thursday, everybody. 1 week till Turkey Day. I am Glenn the Geek from Ocala, Florida.
And I am Dr. Rebecca Jimenez, the turkey eater from Macon, Georgia. And you are listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for October 21st.
Well, wait a minute. That's not right. It's actually November the 21st.
You're right. I'm sorry. I did.
No, my fault.
Episode number 793. This episode is brought to you by Technical Large Animal Emergency Rescue at TLAER.org. And good morning, Horse World.
No need to panic, folks. It's Emergency Preparedness Day on Horses in the Morning. That means Dr. G from Technical Large Animal Emergency Rescue is here to enlighten and inform. So put on your emergency gear and mount up.
And everybody that was driving that just pulled over because they heard the siren, raise your hand. I wonder about that every time we play that opener. You know, I just wonder about it. Hey, sorry about that. It was my fault about the date and the opener there. That was my fault. I apologize.
Yeah, and it's my fault for not catching it. Anyway.
See, we do that
How
to Jamie. I am fine. We do that to Jamie almost every day. We put something in the opener because we know she just reads it because she's so sleepy. So she just reads it, and then we'll put stuff in there to trick her up. And but she's catching on now, so we can't get away with that too much anymore. I am great, and of course, Dr. G is back. This is our emergency preparedness episode that we do once a month here on Horses in the Morning. The last one we did was October the 17th, actually. So if you want to go back and take a listen to that one, if you missed it, and there's been several others, you can just go to horsesinthemorning.com and catch up on those. So, Dr. G, you've had quite a busy month, haven't you? We're going to talk a little bit about that later on.
I have.
And I can't wait to hear about it because you were in a place that's on my bucket list to visit. So I'm going to ask you a little bit about that, too. But let's go to Jennifer first and find out what's coming up on today's show.
On today's? On today's, the cat did, yeah, okay, never mind. The Key Lark with, on today's Key Lark with Dr. G, Thursday edition, Dr. G's travel log opens the show as she provides a look back at the Large Animal Rescue Conference in Australia that she recently attended. And up next, a listener writes in and prompts us to take an honest look at the stupid and sometimes dangerous things and all too relatable things that we do when we are faced with animal emergencies. And we've all got stories for that one. And changing tack midway through our journey, we will be welcoming Michelle Melarno, and I'm sorry, Michelle, for butchering your name, owner of Compassionate Compost, into the show. And yes, we're going to talk about disposal, people. It is an issue that every horse owner or caretaker will have to deal with sometime, so let's just talk about it and be done with it. And rounding out the show, Jenna Letzer stops by for a look at the what-ifs of a rescue situation and the very real relationship that first responders' level of large animal rescue knowledge can have on the potential rescue outcome.
Very good. Thank you, Jennifer. Appreciate that. Well, Dr. G., You got to take a trip and go to, a place that's on my bucket list. I don't know if it's on Jennifer's because she doesn't like planes a whole lot. So 25 hours on a plane isn't very thrilling to her. But
it's only 15.
Oh, okay.
It's only 15. You know what 15 hours means? You go to sleep for 8 and you wake up and you still have to entertain yourself for 7.
That's right. Well, how was Australia?
It was fantastic. It was absolutely fantastic. I will tell you that Australians take their horse industry extremely seriously, and they don't have nearly the population that we do of people, but they have a lot of horses. So everywhere you look, there's horses, cattle, and sheep. And particularly the sheep is important because you know, I have to have some lamb when I go to Australia. I'm a big fan of lamb with mint sauce.
Not live sheep. You're in favor of the dead sheep.
That's exactly right. Yes, and sheep that's been nicely roasted and delivered to me on a plate. Anyway, we were very fortunate. I got a chance to go and speak at the 5th International Large Animal Emergency Rescue Conference, and that was held in South Australia. And Glenn, if you're going to have it on your bucket list, that is the place to go, is South Australia to the Barossa Valley, which is well known for its wine country and excellent weather. Beautiful area, and there was a lot of cheese, there was a lot of lamb, and there was a lot of wine that was drunk at the same time.
Sounds so perfect to me.
In between, we had a conference, and it was quite fantastic. We had 6 countries join us at the conference, me from the United States, and then we had Jim Green, who was a world expert, one of my previous students, and he has taken the ideas and just run with it in the UK and is setting up how to do it across the entire country. So we're well behind him, unfortunately, with our 50 states and 50 opinions, but he was there to speak about corporate risk and how they have been working together with the veterinarians in their country to try to set up a better plan for on-scene safety for their firefighters. They had had some pretty big significant issues with people getting hurt and animals getting damaged. And so they started taking it seriously about 10 years ago, and they have come a long way. And probably it helps a lot because Princess Anne decided that this was a very important issue, and she started putting some of her effort and focus onto it. And it probably makes it a little bit easier in a monarchy to get Princess Anne involved to get other people to be serious about it. So that was pretty neat. Anyway,
I'm looking at some of the other countries involved. You had New Zealand, Australia, obviously, and then you had Thailand, India, and the USA. So, seeing Thailand in there just made me think. Did you guys get? Were you down there before or after the massive typhoon hit the Philippines?
I was down in Australia when the hurricane was hitting, and I was hoping that I was going to be able to leave on the plane the next day. The gentleman from Thailand, I'm glad you brought that up, was Dr. Ian Dacre. He is actually the director for World Society for the Protection of Animals, which is WSPA, and he actually lives in Thailand. He's originally a Kiwi from New Zealand, and he came to speak to us at the conference as well. So we were tickled pink to have him come. And then there was one person from India, and actually it was a wonderful opportunity for me. I was asked to present an international award to Jim Green from the UK for his leadership and all the awesome things that he's been doing in large animal rescue. But then the gentleman from India, I was able to give him an award as well. I gave him the long distance award for coming to the conference. And even though Jim Green had been on a plane for 25 hours and I had been on a plane for 15 hours to get there, Dr. Arvind Sharma from India was on a bus for 12 hours to get there, and
yay,
then got on a plane, et cetera. And, you know, the kind of bus that I'm talking about, Glenn.
Is this the one with the chickens and the goats?
Uh-huh. 12 hours on one of those with the chickens and all the people hanging off the sides, et cetera. He had to have a lot of gumption to endure that kind of a thing. So,
and they don't have Wi-Fi, even the pay-for kind on those buses. There's just
exactly
yeah.
No Wi-Fi.
Exactly.
Of course, Glenn, you would think about Wi-Fi.
Actually, his presentation was quite humbling to those of us that you know, that are so used to having, you know, all the toys and trucks and all those kind of things. His presentation from India was, how do we help animals that are maybe stuck in a ditch or trapped in something up in the mountains where all you have is a few people and maybe some ropes, and maybe even you have to use animal power to try to remove the other animal from the hole. And it was very humbling to the rest of us. So I actually gave him one of my books because I was so impressed with his effort to try to get there. So that was pretty neat. Anyway, the folks that came to this conference were firefighters and rescue experts and even USAR team members, animal control and humane groups, veterinarians and professionals from across the horse, cattle, and even sheep industry. attended. And, of course, we were talking about emergencies, but also disasters and how we handle these large things. Of course, you know, Australia is the country of disasters. They've always having some kind of a disaster, either a drought or a flood or a fire. And when they have fires, their fires are quite impressive. I was, whether it's lucky or not, I got a chance to drive around and look at some of the fires that were burning in Sydney when I got there, and or the after effect of the fires, let's put it that way. And it's amazing to see the scope of some of these fires. And I was very fortunate when I went down to Tasmania after the conference. I spoke at the Australian Veterinarians Association conference down in Tasmania, and I went to visit some of the areas in South Tasmania that had burned last year and observe some of the recovery. And it was amazing. They actually have some organizations that get together. It's called Blaze Aid. They get together and fix fences, because the first problem that they had immediately after the fire is thousands of animals running loose over the roads. And so firefighters and, you know, disaster responders are trying to get down there and help people with their houses, et cetera. And they take a chance on running over some of the livestock that survived. And so they actually have a group that gets together immediately after the fires and goes out and refixes your fence. How amazing is that?
And we've all seen the pictures floating around Facebook, and I want to know if they're true or not, of what happens after the floods in Australia when all of the weird critters and insects gather on one particular farm, and the spiders I'm talking about in particular. Was that a true picture, do you think?
You know? I don't think that was a true picture. That was probably a bit of a conglomeration. But it is true that animals are not dumb, Glenn. It doesn't matter if it's domesticated or wild. They will find the highest ground around. They will try to save themselves.
And if it happens they're not at your farm?
That's right. And so the biggest problem comes in how have you laid out your farm to make it easy for animals to find the high ground to get away from the flooding. You know, if you leave them in their barn or inside a small paddock and they don't have any other option, they're going to die right there, or they're going to get hung up in the fence attempting to get loose. So that's very unfortunate. Huh. But you're right.
So what were the outcomes? What after the presentations, and you probably had breakout sessions and all that stuff. Did you take, now you're one of the leaders in this world here in the United States and around the world. But, you know, we always learn something every time any of us do these. So what did you take away from it personally?
The biggest thing that I was concerned about when I went down to Australia, they have been working on trying to get some equipment and do training over the last 5 years. They've had several people that have done tours around the world to get some information and bring it back to Australia. I got a chance to do some training several times down there, and I was just concerned to make sure that they had some kind of a point person, because it's just their government's just like ours. You know how that is. If somebody's not pushing from the top, you won't get too much forward movement. So I was very tickled at the very end. One of the SES rescue people, who is also an appointed person within their government, stood up and raised his hand and said that he was willing to be the point person for all of Australia from the rescue and fire services to take this on as a project on how they should do their procedures, how they should coordinate their training and their equipment and come up with some standards. And it almost brought me to tears, because we have been trying to get that here in the United States for 20 years and nobody has taken it seriously. So I was very excited to see that in Australia, and all the movers and shakers were at this conference from across Australia. So we were extremely excited about that. I think Australia has got their feet on the ground and they are moving in the desired direction. So I'll be watching closely to see what happens with that. And personally, it was really neat because it was sort of like old home week for me. I got a chance to see a bunch of people that I've seen in the past, either students of mine or colleagues, and really enjoyed the presentations from everybody. And you're right, you learn something at every single training. And I was learning more than they were learning from me, I can guarantee you that.
Well, terrific. That's great. Now tell me, you obviously got to have some fun while you were there too. Was there something memorable that you can actually talk about on the air?
Yes, absolutely. I think one of the most memorable things that I got when I left that conference and went down to speak at the Australian Veterinarians Association conference, there was a little man who came up to me, obviously quite older, probably in his 70s. He had on a Quarantine Matters hat, which I thought was quite cute. And he was a veterinarian, and he was sort of frantically looking around at this conference with all these people. He said, "I'm looking for the American." And I overheard him say, "I'm looking for the American." Well, it's sort of hard to miss me.
You're
I'm
6 foot two. I mean,
mind you. So I said, I'm probably the American that you're looking for. Who are you looking for? And he said, "I'm looking for Rebecca." I said, "That's me." And it turns out that he, his name is James Harris, Dr. James Harris, and he used to be big up in California many years ago, and was, I think he was even the director of the California Veterinary Medical Association. So he's a big wig, and he believed in large animal rescue 20, 30 years ago and supported some of the efforts of Dr. John Madigan at the University of California at Davis. In creating the Anderson Sling and some of those kinds of things that they were doing back then. So small world, what's the chances of running into this person all these years later? And I had heard of him, but I'd never met him. And here he is at the conference with his little Quarantine Matters shirt on. I mean, his hat on. I thought that was cute.
Now, was this you said this was a veterinary, sort of like our AEP conference in Texas?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yes.
Now they have
Tasmanian veterinarians together.
They actually have some diseases we don't deal with, but they've had quite a problem with them in the last couple of years. The one starts with an H. I can't remember what's it called.
Hendra.
Yeah,
it's Hendra.
I assume that was a topic of conversation again.
It's funny because you know they do not have rabies in their country because they practice quarantine and keep it out of their country, but they have Hendra, which is a Lyssa virus, and it can affect both people and horses and kill both. And apparently there's been 4 veterinarians over the years that have died from exposure to Lyssa virus, to this Lyssa virus. They actually got organized and they came up the Queensland Horse Council with the work of Debbie Decker and some other people within the Queensland Horse Council pushed really hard and worked with what is now Zoetis, used to be Pfizer, to come up with a vaccine. And of course now, the challenge is to get the vaccine out to these horses. And it's not just about saving the horses. It's about saving veterinarians because this is sort of like rabies. It's a very neurologic presentation. And, you know, people think, oh, their horse is just sick. Their horse is doing something funny. The veterinarian comes and tries to treat the horse for what looks like colic or something unusual. And then later on, you find out that it was this Lyssa virus and it can kill people. So they're working really hard on trying to pursue that. But other than that, they are pretty strong in their efforts to try to prevent diseases. I've been pretty impressed with their effort in the horse industry and the involvement of not only the veterinarians, but also the horse people in educating themselves about diseases. I think sometimes here in the United States, people take a little bit more of a backseat attitude towards that as horse owners. They
well, I was
probably
just
a little bit more educated.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, we have a pretty condensed population in the United States compared to a lot of places. I mean, yeah, there's some really rural parts, but everybody, you know, is more in tune with what's going on. And Australia, you have some really rural parts up there in the north. So that, I imagine that's one of their challenges is, you know, getting people to use the vaccines in areas that they aren't real connected to the outside world.
It is. It is definitely difficult to do that. And of course, the vaccine, because there's such a small population of people that are actually going to use it. I mean, only the Hendra virus is only in Australia, so they're only going to be able to sell it in Australia. So it's a little bit
price.
More expensive
yeah.
than, you know, it's not a $10 rabies vaccine. But anyway, they're making a challenge. And your point about these very long distances between facilities and areas where people live is also applicable to large animal rescue. That's part of their challenges. When they have something like a cattle turnover or a horse trailer, they call them floats, by the way. When you go floating, that means you're trailering. I thought that was sort of interesting. But when you have a float wreck in Australia and you're out between cattle stations, you may be waiting hours to get assistance. And so a lot of the interest from Australians has been, you know, they're very much more like, hey, I want to learn how to deal with this myself, because I may not be able to wait until the fireys get here or the emergency services folks. And so there's a lot of interest from horse owners, even at the conference. We had quite a few professional horse owners. And the other thing, and I've got a challenge for you, Glenn.
Okay.
For the very first time, the racing industry has gotten involved in getting some education and equipment to deal with large animal rescue. Now, I know you're thinking, well, racing, there's no pits around the racetracks. There's nothing for a horse to fall into. But if you think about it, racehorses travel all the time. They are in large trailers, small trailers of all types all the time. So that obviously happens. But the other thing that happens, and nobody ever wants to talk about it, is horses flip over in racing gates. They get trapped
the starting
in all
gates.
Kinds of situations.
Yep. Yep.
They jump over. You know, everybody always wants to walk down and pet all the horses at the racetrack when they're hanging their heads over. Do you think a thoroughbred jumps across those things once in a while?
Yeah.
Of course they do.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, up till now, I've been pushing for years, but of course, it's sort of an insular group and been trying to get some information out to the racing people about how we could better approach barn fires, which kills lots of racehorses, and deal with the barrier attendants, the people that, you know, end up being the poor beggar that has to push the horse into the racing gate, those kind of things. There's a lot of training and small equipment changes that they could use to educate some of those people. And especially since many of the folks that work at the racetrack are, English is not their primary language. So I am on a mission to try to change that here in the United States. If you know some of the racing folks, I would love to have them come to a training sometime or talk to them about what we've been doing in Australia. Australia has done several trainings with some of my previous students about large animal rescue and how that relates to the racing industry, and, you know, helping them put a more positive spin on what they're doing to try to assist animals that get in those kinds of situations. So I was really excited. And Anthony Hatch, who had won a fellowship and got a chance to visit here in the United States a few years ago, he's been pushing that really hard. And I got a chance to meet with some of the gurus in the racing industry of there at the conference, and they're really excited. They're really pushing. They understand that this is about risk assessment. They understand the corporate risk challenges, and they want to reduce the number of injuries to the people that work at the racetrack. So I was pretty excited. So that's the gauntlet that I am throwing to the United States racing industry, is let's get more serious about doing some training, getting people educated, and preventing some of the problems that we've had in the past.
And every one of them should have one of our sponsors' rescue glides, that's for sure, at the track, you know, and know how to use it. But you gave me a good transition, because you were talking about people learning how to do things on their own. And we had a listener comment on our Facebook page after your last show. And I'd like to read it to you, because she had a question at the end. And, you know, it's a little bit long, but I think it's important. She said, I personally participated in frantic and unsafe attempts by owners and bystanders on scene to assist animals when my mare overestimated her ability to leap and got herself clotheslined up over a chain gate to a campground corral. There was no way I was going to stand around and wait for emergency responders to arrive. Instead, I went to the corral, grabbed one hind leg, recruited a thankfully naive to horse's friend to grab the other hind leg, and we just boosted her up and over. I know, it's the kill zone. But I probably do it all over again, even after reading the excellent TLAR book, which is yours. So she's read the book. In retrospect, I realized how dangerous it was. But at the time, well, frankly, I can't barely remember how I got inside the corral. I just flew into action when I saw her strung up like that. I certainly wouldn't have tried what I did with a horse I don't know well. I also felt at the time was of essence, and the situation would have become progressively more dangerous the longer she had been trapped. My question is, would you ever advise owners on how they might practice or practically assess whether they should make an exception to a good safe practices when they know their animal's help might be hours away? So, in other words, I assume this one had its front legs over the chain. That's what I'm kind of gathering here. That's what I'm kind of seeing.
Yep. Which probably hung right on his gut.
In his armpits or something, you know, something like that. You know, what happens in these situations, and any one of us that have been around for 25 years doing this and have had tons of horses, there's those situations that you just react, and whether it's correct or not, and we, you know, we had this discussion before the show, your reaction changes the younger you are or the older you are. So, you know, the younger you are, the braver you are. Now we're getting at the age that I am, you know, I think twice about it now and go, okay, is this horse going to kill me when I'm trying to save it? There's a hesitation now where there wasn't when you're young and stupid. So I'll let you answer that.
Yep. Yeah, and you're right. Every one of us has got this kind of story. The right answer is no, that there's not a horse in the world that's worth your life and potentially a piece of your body, particularly within the emergency services where we have such a litigious society. That is absolutely the correct answer. There is not a horse in the world that's worth going in there and getting your finger pinched or getting kicked or getting killed. But even for individual horse owners, I say the answer is no, it's not worth it. Find a better way. Instead of going in there and grabbing the hind legs, you should have a reciprocating saw with a battery pack in your trailer, because that's what I preach all the time. Reciprocating saw, about $100. You're looking for a Christmas gift for you or your buddies at the barn, get them a reciprocating saw with a battery pack. Keep it charged at all times. You should have one in your horse trailer, and you should have one in your barn. Because horses do these kind of things. And with a reciprocating saw.
I can't tell you how many times, Dr. G, that would have saved my, you know what.
Yeah, yep. When hauling in the trailer.
I really could have used one.
Yeah.
In the trailer, they go over the chest bars.
Yep.
They just do those kind of things. They hang themselves. I've seen horses kick over the back door, the butt bar, kick over that and get their foot hung between the butt bar and the door. Any of those things can be easily solved by a reciprocating saw with lots of blades. You're going to go through different kinds of blades for whatever kind of material. But, you know, getting in there and putting your hands on the legs just is not acceptable. We won't let a firefighter do it, and he's got a helmet on. So what about a horse person that doesn't have a helmet on? I can't imagine doing that. And, you know, there we mentioned this on the show before. There was a guy over in the UK back last fall, about a year ago, who he and his daughter and his wife were driving down the road. They had a horse. I think the horse's name was Hedgehog. He was driving down the road. He felt something going funny in the trailer. He crawled into the trailer to try to help the horse for whatever was the problem. The horse kicked him in the head. His wife tried to, you know, then he ended up underneath the horse. His wife tried to crawl in the trailer to try to get the horse to calm down so she could help get her husband out. The horse broke her femur.
Whoa.
At that point, stepped on the guy's head and killed him. The daughter ended up getting transported to the hospital in shock. So, you know, lots of injuries there and one person killed, just going into something that the rest of us in the horse industry sometimes take for granted that, oh, it's just a horse trailer. To a firefighter, that is what we call a confined space. And it's a confined space without an obstacle that doesn't understand English and wears steel shoes. So it's not worth taking a chance. What's really funny is, she described that situation. What's really funny is horses go into a kind of a sulk, which is a physical form of sedation. When they're trapped like that, they'll sort of hang. And so actually you do have a little bit of time. People say, oh, well, you don't have any time. We got to do something. We just get in there and do something. Well, it's the getting there and do something without coming up with a plan first. And you notice that she said something about, I conned my friend into grabbing
yes,
the other
the
leg.
Friend that doesn't know anything about horses.
Naive about horses. You know, that's just, to me, the worst case scenario could have happened is somebody get hurt and possibly even get killed. I don't want to put my friends in that kind of situation. And you're right, I'm over 45, so I do take more of an attitude of let's be more careful than I did when I was 20-something. But, you know, I had a horse in a similar situation when I was 20-something. He went over into the manger and hung himself into the manger trying to get out of the trailer too fast. And I was by myself, and I opened up the back of the trailer. I opened the ramp. I moved the divider over, and then I moved his leg, which is one leg was sticking through the side window. I picked that up and moved it back in. He was just sort of sulking and hanging there, and then I stepped back and waited till he struggled and got himself righted. I did not go in the horse box, and I was only 20-something, so it's not worth it, folks. Stay out of that position, find some equipment, get yourself some tools. That's what we talk about in large animal rescue all the time. Come up with some tools. And we're not talking about spending thousands of dollars. We're talking about some rescue straps, like the ones that Hest sells, one of our sponsors for the show, a rescue strap or two, a boat hook, and maybe a piece of rope, some webbing. It doesn't take a lot, and then a reciprocating saw with a battery pack. So you can promulgate most of your rescues with just those things, and that's what I tell veterinarians.
Yeah, and we've had situations, especially trailering, and you know, we've gotten to a show before where you know you go around the back, and all you see is 4 feet up in the air, you know, two horse trailer, and you see the feet up in the air, and that's when panic sets in. You know, but you're right about the sulking thing. I never really thought about that because even horses that are cast sort of, they'll thrash for a little bit and then they go into, I always thought of it as shutdown mode, but you're right. That's exactly what happens. They'll hang out until somebody comes and helps them out.
Exactly right.
Yeah. I think it depends on the horse, how long it takes for them to get to that point and how much thrashing they do ahead of that. But
that's exactly right.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, you did a perfect lead in to our sponsor. Why don't you talk about them?
Today's show is brought to you with the support of Hest slings and water rescue harnesses and rescue straps. Dr. Kathleen Becker makes the Becker rescue sling. It can be applied for short-term vertical lift of animals in lots of situations, everything from lame horses needing farriery to lifting an animal out of a ravine or a hole, and we even use it in extrication from mud. It is widely used by fire departments, rescue squads, and animal response teams in all over the world now, including Australia. I just had one of my clients in Australia buy a water rescue harness developed by Dr. Kathleen Becker. For disaster scenarios such as the horse trapped in floodwaters, it seems to happen in Australia quite often, and where they just need some support to swim to safe ground. So Hest is located in Virginia and is owned by Dr. Becker. You can contact her at rescue.hastpsc.com, or you can call her, which is the best way to get a hold of her, at 518-302-0784 and just leave a message.
Very good. Well, before we get to your first guest, I'm going to give a little disclaimer here. When you sent over the show notes about a week ago about who we were going to be talking to, and I saw the topic that's coming up next, I actually called Jennifer and I said, you know, I don't know if that this is appropriate for the morning show because we kind of have a silly, fun show here. But, you know, people learn stuff, but it's morning show, right? And, you know, I said, I don't know if this is a topic for the morning show. And Jennifer said, yeah, but think about it. You know, with all the horses we've had over our lifetime, which is a lot, and we've had a lot of seniors that we've had to put down, we've always had a problem with either we lived in an area that you're not allowed to bury horses, and then you had to call the knackers, which we had a horrendous experience with that once, and we never called them after that. You know, we always found another way after that because I'm not even going to go into it because it just was awful. So, you know, after she brought those things up, you know, I realized that this is something that we have to, every horse owner has to deal with at some point or another. And it's a very difficult situation because there's not a lot of options. So that's when I decided, okay, we will go into this particular topic with poor Michelle, who now had to listen to my disclaimer and then come on the show. So go ahead and introduce her.
You're right. I met Michelle Malaragno in 2008, and she got really serious about technical large animal emergency rescue information and training very quickly. She hosted a couple operations courses in Maine for us, and over that time became an assistant instructor for me. And she has even gotten the chance to go with me to some courses in Canada, and I invited her to help me as we got a chance to go down to Bogota, Colombia back in 2011. She has really taken the concepts of TLR, particularly handling recumbent horses, into a whole new business, literally a new business, trying to find a better end game for horses. She calls it compassionate composting, where she uses TLR techniques to pick up and move dead horses in a more gentle and more green environmental way to convert their bodies. You're exactly right, Glenn. If you think about it, there's 9.2 million horses in the United States today, and that means that sometime in the next 30 years, that's 9.2 million horses that are going to die, and at some point, somebody's going to have to move their body, and trying to find a way to handle that in a better manner than slapping a chain around its foot and moving it, is really what she's trying to bring to this. So, Michelle, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
How are you this morning?
I'm good. It's a little chilly here in Maine, but I'm sure that's not a surprise to you.
Is there snow?
There's no snow.
Talk about living in
there
a place
no
where
snow.
Talk about living in a place where you can't bury horses for 6 months out of the year. You're living in one of them.
Yes, I am, and it definitely makes for a little bit of difficulty with the number of options that are available. So, yeah, we tend to have several feet of frost, and well, it's kind of like trying to dig into concrete.
Right. Yeah.
Why don't you talk a little bit about how you got compassionate composting started and why?
Sure. I just, you know, throughout the years of being involved as an individual horse owner, as well as my involvement in the horse industry here in Maine and the Northeast, as a veterinary assistant, manager of some large animal-related facilities, it became pretty obvious that there's definitely a need for alternatives to handling large deceased animals. You know, burial has always been sort of the standard, but that has definitely becoming more difficult with prohibitive municipal ordinances and environmental concerns and cremation. Cremation actually has become more available for larger animals like horses in recent years.
But it's not cheap.
It's not cheap. It is a very costly method. I heard a couple of folks have said that it's about $1 a pound. If your average horse is 1,000 pounds, it's $1,000.
Whoa.
And if you wish to have the ashes back, you have an additional charge typically on top of that.
Hmm.
But yeah, pretty costly. Rendering plants, of course, have become less plentiful, I guess, if you will. And, there's the option of landfills, but a lot of the landfills are not accepting large animals any longer.
Rendering has also got the problem lately of they're starting to realize how many drugs people are actually putting into their horses, usually for good purposes, not the bad drugs, but they started realizing, you know, even if that's going into pet food, there may be some concerns with that going into pet food. So that's why they're not quite so turned on about that anymore. Didn't you go to some schooling to learn how to actually do some of this composting?
Yes. There's actually a great program, thankfully for me, located right here in Maine. The Maine Compost Team, which is comprised of folks from the Department of Agriculture, the University of Maine system, the DEP, and the State Planning Office, they have a Maine compost school that they host three or four times a year now here in Maine. And then they've also, in recent years, started to go on the road with that. So they have actually developed a bit of a more international presence and have become a very well-known and award-winning compost school. So I did that course and then worked very closely with the development of my site compost management plan with that team to get some zoning ordinance amendments and to sort of get the planning piece and the approval piece through my city to get that accomplished.
What do your neighbors think about you doing this?
Well, I'm pretty lucky in that my closest neighbor is almost a mile away. So
that's just far enough.
Just far enough, yep. I am my house is located about 1,000 feet from the actual compost facility, which is really just consists of a packed gravel prepared site of about 100 feet by 200 feet right now. And it's very carefully constructed. Ideally, it should be someday I'll have some grant opportunities to put in the compost pad made of concrete instead of just the packed gravel, but that's down the road. But there are really no offensive issues with visiting the compost site itself. I have a lot of folks who want to come visit after, you know, their horse has passed away. If I have picked it up and brought it to my facility for the above-ground burial and the composting process, they often want to come visit. And they're pretty surprised at what it looks like and what and the fact that there's just nothing offensive about it.
Okay.
I gotta say, Glenn,
yeah.
When you visit her facility, I got a chance to visit it twice, and it is sort of powerful because it's basically sort of like visiting a cemetery. There's absolutely no smell. There's no smell. It's amazing. And what she was saying about some of the people that were visiting, she has their pile different from everybody else's pile. And when I was there, there was one lady who had come to visit her horse, and there was a rosary right on top of the pile. She had come to visit her horse and brought a rosary. And I was just like, wow, that's really cool. At first I was a little bit freaked out about it, but when I was there, it was so well done and so different from what I sort of expected that I was really impressed. That's why I wanted to bring her on the show.
Well, let me ask a couple of questions that I'm going to regret. Okay.
You won't regret it. I promise.
Okay. All right. So we have actually composted. I've never used that term before. It's not really how I was thinking about it, but it's what we did. You know, when we had manure piles in the wintertime where we then scooped them up and spread them when the weather got better or whatever. And you'd had cats that died. You couldn't bury them. The ground was frozen, or you had 2 feet of snow when we lived in Pennsylvania. So we put them to compost in the manure pile. And then, you know, probably 2-3 months later, when we went out to spread, there's nothing left. So we have done that on a very small scale ourselves. I didn't realize that's what we were doing. You know, I didn't think about it as composting, so to speak. Now, you need a material to do that. So this is one of the questions I hope I don't regret. What material do you use?
The primary material that I use is actually the bedding, so the shavings and the manure that comes right out of horse stalls. So for these larger stables that have 10, 12, or 20 horses that they house in stalls each night, and they're cleaning stalls every morning, they have a large manure pile that I'm able to access and utilize as the bulking material for the above-ground burials and the composting process.
Well, so you basically are using the same thing we did, is the manure pile.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, on-farm composting for a lot of your larger cattle facilities, dairy facilities, has been the standard, not just an accepted method, but actually the, the farm management plan technique that has been utilized for decades, probably longer, for those on-farm animal mortalities.
Yeah, Glenn, you got to remember, Glenn, that the cattle and the commercial facilities have been far more regulated than horse facilities. Horse people for so long have resisted anybody telling them how to do things, and unfortunately, that's why a lot of horse facilities have got a bad rap as being environmentally making some serious degradation of the environment, because they wear out the soil and they don't rotate their pastures. And when you drive by some horse facilities, they look pretty bad. If a cattle facility looked like that, there would be some regulatory part of the government that would be stepping in and saying, hey, you got to fix that. But that's not true of horse facilities.
And I know all of us horse people
would not permit them to bury that many.
Well, yeah, and I was going to say, you know, we lived in a town where we weren't allowed to bury horses, and we buried many of them there anyway because, nobody questioned it. That is getting tougher as the towns are getting tougher about that, and as the towns are moving out to our farms, too. That's the other thing.
Right, and most people don't even really think about calling their town to find out what the burial permissions are. There are a couple of really good reasons to do that. One is to find out, like I said, if it's even permitted. And secondly, also to find out what the setback regulations are to, houses or other buildings, wells, property lines, roadways, that sort of thing. If it is permitted, you should at least be aware of that. But, you know, and the folks who are boarding their horses as well, a lot of the boarding facilities have gotten to the point where, you know, after several years in their business, they're sort of, for lack of a better term, running out of room to bury horses and, you know, discovering that they need to let their boarders know that they don't permit the horses to be buried on their property. So,
okay. Let me make a comment about that, Glenn. You have seen there has been several over the years. You want to talk about icky, where people had buried horses and they don't realize how big a hole you've got to have. I mean, it's a freaking hole to China.
Yeah, I know. I do know that.
Well, in many soil types, the soil engineers will tell you that that soil is going to be destabilized for up to 10 years. And there have been, unfortunately, several cases where people have buried a horse, and a year or two later, after a big storm or something, another horse comes along and gets stuck in the mud over that burial site because of the destabilization. So it's also dangerous to your live horses that are out there in that pasture.
Yeah, we never actually buried in pastures that there were other, you know, we buried outside of a pasture. I wouldn't even think about doing that, actually, to be honest. And just instinct tells me that's a bad idea. Now, I'm going to ask you another question I'm going to regret. But apparently that's what I'm doing this morning. So,
well, I don't know. Did you regret the answer to that first question?
No. Actually, it was kind of like, well, I did that before. So now you have this large area, and I didn't realize that they were all, you know, individual mounds, let's say.
Well, some of them are.
Okay.
Not all of them.
Okay. But how long do you leave them there forever like that? Or is there a point, a year or whatever later, that you can move that pile out and you put a new pile in? You know what I'm asking?
Yeah, I do. And actually, it's a pretty interesting process. You know, when we put something in the ground, that's a very sort of cold environment. So in some cases, it takes years, and there are documented cases of it being decades before the animal is really fully decomposed. With an above-ground composting process, it's what they call a thermophilic process that's happening. So you're generating, if you build the pile properly, you're generating very high temperatures within the pile. So it creates a much faster process that the body of the animal gets decomposes. And at about 3.5 to 4 months, that process has come to the point where there are really only bones left. It's, you know, when people think about composting, when I first start talking with people about it, they think of it in terms of their kitchen compost that they are told to turn all the time.
Right.
And you don't do that in this type of a pile. You just leave it. Kind of like your manure pile. You kind of leave it there, and maybe you turn it a couple times a year. But when a pile is built with a large animal within it, it's left as a static pile for about 3 to 4 months. And I have to check temperatures regularly to make sure that I'm getting, you know, proper air coming into the pile and getting the proper temperatures. And it just the process actually happened pretty quickly.
What about
the compost that is produced is actually a marketable product. So it can be used as a soil amendment for mulches or other compost material use.
She actually has some folks who want to have their horse delivered back to them. That's why she has the single piles. She wants to, some of them want to have it delivered back to their, to be able to put around their flowers, which is a pretty cool way of bringing your horse back onto your property. And
right.
Michelle, can you talk a little bit? I know one of the big questions a lot of our listeners are going to have is, what about if I have my horse put down by the veterinarian using euthasol or phenobarbital? What is that going to do to the soil?
Right. Well, first I'll start with the concerns with burial, of course, are the soil contamination and the possibility of not just the body of the animal, but the euthanasia solution getting into a water source. So that's an environmental concern that has become, you know, folks are becoming more aware of that. With composting, the studies that have been done are showing that there is either no residual amount of the euthanasia solution left, or the amount that they are detecting through testing is such a negligible amount that they've placed no restrictions on the use of that end compost product.
That's awesome.
There's a realization that obviously they do need to do more testing, because this is still sort of a fairly new application, a fairly new process for taking care of the deceased animals, but especially the ones that have been chemically euthanized.
Let me say something about that, Glenn. FEMA and some of the USDA and those kind of folks, they've really been looking at this composting because, you saw what happened in the UK back in 2001 with the foot and mouth disease. And foreign animal diseases are a big deal. And when they have to euthanize large numbers of animals due to some horrific disease, they started realizing that ground, all you're doing when you put it in the ground is you're just waiting till somebody digs it up 150 years from now and doesn't realize that they're there. You're not eliminating the situation. What they're understanding is that composting, the temperatures get so hot, they actually destroy the viruses, and that's what they're looking at for how to handle these kind of things. Now, obviously, you have to quarantine the facility while those organisms are being cooked in the composting. But this is where our government is going, is looking at composting. And it just makes a lot more sense than trying to put it in the ground or spending so much energy to try to burn it.
Well, there's one other question before we run out of time here that all the listeners are wanting to know the answer to, and that's cost.
Sure. I'm sorry, it's what?
Cost. The price.
Cost. Yeah. So that's been an interesting sort of journey for me to come up with a cost.
Yeah, there weren't a whole lot of models you could look at and go, oh, this is my business plan here.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And as I developed that business plan, and people have asked, well, who are your competitors? And it's really difficult to find competitors and to find a baseline. My goal in developing the cost has sort of been to stay a little bit under what it would cost someone to rent an excavator and hire an operator to dig a hole big enough to bury a horse. In this area, that can range between $300 and $500, $600, $700 a day to rent an excavator and hire an operator. I'm sort of using a baseline right now for providing the pickup service and the handling. And actually, I'd like to come back to the handling in a second. So my base for that is around $375. And then obviously with I have to, consider mileage charges beyond that. Maine is a pretty big place, and actually I've picked up in other states in New England as well. So, fuel is not cheap, and you certainly have to consider that. The other additional cost is if an owner wants their horse individually composted in order to get all or some of the compost and compost material back, there's an additional charge for that because it's more labor for me and utilizing more bulky material and that sort of thing.
Talk a little bit about using the glide to come. Describe a scenario real quick.
Sure. So kind of going back to your first question with how or why this all started, one of the biggest things for me was seeing that there was an issue with, Glenn, you said it in your introduction, how horrific the process was when you had to take care of a horse that had died. And it is horrific for most owners to go through their animal dying, but they were most often more traumatized and more affected by some random person showing up, wrapping a cable around the neck and dragging their horse onto a flatbed. So I utilized the technical large animal emergency rescue techniques and equipment, specifically the rescue glide, to carefully place the animal on the glide and package it just like it were a live animal, and then pull the glide onto my enclosed trailer with a mechanical winch. And it's just so much nicer for the owners to witness. And almost every owner has actually wanted to be a part of that process because they're, number one, learning how to handle the animal, you know, even for a live animal in a TLR type of a situation. But they're also comforted enough to want to be a part of that process right to the very end with their horse instead of being horrified and having to go away.
I'm glad that we got a chance to talk about that this morning, Michelle, because one of the things that I always try to remind people in the fire service and emergency services that I normally work with is that many times this is one person's horse. They've had that horse for 20 or 30 years. Yeah. They have an emotional connection to it. It is a pet, no different than a dog to them. It's part of their family. And now they're observing that process. And they would never see that if that was their mother or father. It would be taken care of by emergency services. And
right.
You are providing a true service for those folks. And I really appreciate you coming on the show this morning.
Well, like I said, I really appreciate the opportunity because it is something that I'm, you know, very invested in and very passionate about. And you know, one of the last things that I'll just make a quick comment on is that sort of going forward for me here is working closely with horse owners and just sort of getting the educational piece out there about planning ahead for the end-of-life decisions for your horse. I think we think about it for our small animals a little bit more readily. We don't want to think about it, but for some reason, we just don't really take the time to think about or plan ahead for our horses. And oftentimes, we don't have a lot of time to plan for it in the case of an emergency.
Yeah, you are exactly right. Make that phone call today. Find someone in your local area that can assist you with that and hope that you're hope that your plan doesn't have to be enacted for the next 20 years, but
right.
At least you got a plan.
And if you
thank
have a plan,
so
you shouldn't need to use it.
Thank you so much for your time this morning, Michelle. We really appreciate
Absolutely.
You coming on. And Michelle's website is CompassionateComposting.com, or you can visit her on the Facebook page, Facebook Compassionate Composting. Thank you so much, Michelle, for your time.
Thank you very much. You folks take care.
Glenn, see, that wasn't quite so bad, was it?
Well, no, I got through that. I'm actually glad we did it, although I can honestly say that this is one of the first times that, or is the first time in 3,200 episodes that we've had this discussion. Now Michelle has
good.
To now Michelle has to sell franchises across the country so that it's an option everywhere. So, Michelle, that's your next challenge, Michelle. You need to take Compassionate Composting and sell franchises. That ought to be interesting training school to go to.
She actually has two people that are interested in doing that here in the Southeast that are already talking to her about how to do that. So you're exactly right. It's not something that you can just, you know, go slap some bulking material and slap a carcass on top of it and throw some more stuff on it. It actually is a science. Dr. Shea Poor, out when she was at Virginia Tech, she was actually doing a lot of research into how to do that, particularly for horses, to make it not smelly and make it an efficient process. And there's a lot of people that actually put a lot of research into that.
Well, let's take a break. There's a song that I have never been able to use before on the show because I thought it's called Long Ride Home by Patty Hall. But after this conversation this morning, it's a perfect song to use. And I actually like this song. I've just never been able to use it before. So we're going to do that. And we're going to come back. We have another guest coming up with a little bit lighter stories, I think. She has some interesting stories of rescues and things that we're going to hear about in just a minute. We'll be right back. Back after Patty Hall and Long Ride Home.
Long black memories, shiniest sky I've ever seen. Back to his nest and sleep. Rides as quiet as a dream. Someone dug a hole 6 long feet in the ground. I said goodbye to you and I threw my roses down. Ain't nothing left at all in the end of this crowd with me riding in this car and you flying through them clouds. I've had some time to think about it and watch the sun sink like a storm. I've had some time to think about you on the long night wind. One day I took your tiny hand, put your finger in the ring band. Daddy gave it to the land. Made ourselves the best of friends. 40 years go by with someone laying in your bed. 40 years of things you say you wished you'd never said. How hard would it have been to say some kind of words instead? I wonder as I stare up at the sky of turning red.
Right, you are listening to Horses in the Morning. I am Glenn the Geek, and I am here with Dr. G from Technical Large Animal Emergency Rescue. We are here with the emergency preparedness episode that we do on Horses in the Morning once a month, and I know we have a lot of listeners that tune in for this, and we really appreciate you being here. And this episode is brought to you also by Large Rescue Glides. Tell about them, Dr. G.
Large rescue glides, it's the most useful equipment to easily and safely move large animals, especially when they're down, whether they're sick or injured, lame, if they've got to be transported to definitive veterinary treatment. It's really a staple of TLR teams and racetracks and rodeos and eventing ambulance and veterinary clinics the world over. The signature green recycled plastic large rescue glide is durable, easy to clean, and it comes with all the accessories required to safely restrain an animal upon it. Ask whether your veterinarian owns one. If you ever have an injured or sick horse, this is really the only safe way to move it out of the rain and the dark of the pasture to your barn or load it on a trailer for transport to the veterinary clinic. You can contact Ben McCracken at 864-270-1344, or you can visit his website at www.rescueglides.com, or you can email him at Ben McCracken with two C's at rescueglides.com.
Very good. Well, our next guest is ready. Is it a little lighter topic this time because it's half hour? We'll find out, I guess. Why don't you introduce Jenna for us?
Good morning, Jenna. Jenna Letzer
studied equine business and facilities management at Otterbein University up in Ohio. It was up there that she took her first course with me. That was a couple of years ago. After graduation from Otterbein, she spent 3 years as a barn manager for the Circle P Sanctuary, which is a nonprofit horse rescue and animal sanctuary in Marengo, Ohio. And apparently she was able to use a lot of her large animal rescue training there. Then she's, you know, after getting a chance to go out on some of those rescue calls, she moved back to her original home, which is near Chicago, and she is now the adoption coordinator for the Hooves Animal Humane Society, which is in Woodstock, Illinois. It's a huge organization that works really hard with the, quote, salvage, neglect, abuse cases, but now they're starting to realize that technical rescue is also useful. So good morning, Jenna.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. What's the temperature like in Chicago today?
It's actually pretty warm today, nice and rainy and muddy.
Did you guys manage to avoid the tornadoes earlier this week?
We did. We got a lot of wind, but they actually didn't come that far north, so we were safe from the damage at least.
Well, down here in Georgia, watching the news, you would have thought the entire Midwest was being sucked up in the tornado.
It was pretty scary. I was in the basement.
Oh, you were? You did go in the basement. Did you take your dogs?
Just the cats, yes.
Good. Awesome. Well, Jenna, why don't you tell us a little bit about, you had an experience with a mare that fell into a pond in February. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what happened?
Sure. Well, this was at Circle P, and we had gotten a call actually from the dog warden that they needed our help. A horse had fallen in some water. The people that had called actually they had no idea who to call, so they called the dog warden, but luckily she knew about us. So we kind of grabbed a bunch of ropes and blankets and anything we could think of, but the property was about a half hour away. We're like way out in the country, you know, so the whole way there, we're able to get there on time, but, you know, even rushing, we were still, you know, 20 minutes past, and by the time we got there, the fire truck was there, a fireman in a suit was in the water with the horse. It was a very tiny pond. I mean, it was only about chest deep, you know, maybe about your arm's length wide. It looks like they had just dug it out for some water. But the horse had fallen in, and the fireman there.
Because that's what horses do. Right?
Exactly. You know, this huge property in a tiny little pond, and she managed to find her way into it.
Let's go swimming in February. So, that sounds like fun in Ohio.
Right? So it was kind of crazy. And, you know, luckily it wasn't too cold, but it was starting to snow, so it wasn't really the greatest. But we got there, and a fireman was in with the horse, but they had tied a rope around the horse's neck and tied that rope to a truck, and were just trying to, like, haul her out.
Let me add to that, because that's what firemen do. Okay, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they were trying. They had been there for a good half an hour, and, you know, you could tell they cared. They just didn't know what else to do. So when we got there, we, you know, instructed them how to bring the rope, you know, around her legs and stuff and kind of resituate that. And we actually found a piece of plastic siding, like, you know, for a building. And we're able to kind of slide that under her and then kind of all pull her out. And once we were there, she was out in less than a minute, you know. But it was so cold.
Good girl.
She was in the water. So the training really did help. I mean, I took that class, you know, years ago thinking, oh, this is interesting, but, you know, I'm never really probably going to use this, but, you know, it's interesting, you know, and then we get this call that there's a horse in the water, and we show up, and it's the real deal, and I was like, oh, my gosh, it was nuts, it was crazy, so it was great to have that training, at least, I mean, you know, she had been in the water for so long, there wasn't too much we could do, but at least once we were there, we knew we could get her out.
And you were aware, obviously, that she was probably pretty hypothermic, so the veterinarian was on the scene as well?
He came on the scene about 15 minutes after we had been there. And we, you know, it was a 22, 23-year-old mare, you know, middle of February. She'd been in the water for an hour. You know, we hauled her out, put blankets on, but we were, you know, talking to the owners. You know, I don't know if she's going to make it. But the vet came, and he's wanted to try. The owners wanted to try. And, you know, gave her a warm IV, gave her an enema, and, you know, we were doing everything. It was cold. We were pulling out our hand warmers and putting it on, you know, like her jugular, like anything we could think of. That, you know, just to help her. So, and this was, I think we got the call around maybe 9 or 10 a.m., and we didn't leave there till like 4:35. Mm. So it was a very long process. And, you know, we weren't able to save the mare. And it was just so hard because the owner, it was their family horse for like 20 years. And it was just so hard, and she was fighting, and we thought she'd make it. The vet was like pretty certain she'd make it. So he left. And we were just kind of hanging out with her because we got her sternal finally. And he left. He's like, you know, she has a really good chance. Just keep her moving. And once she's up, you know, get her somewhere even warmer, because we were still out in the field at this point.
Well, you will be glad to know, since you live in Illinois, that your Illinois Fire Institute, Ray Kalvinsky and Dr. Deke Carls, are working really hard. They have just developed we talked to Deke last month. They've just developed and rolled out a large animal rescue awareness course for firefighters across Illinois. Actually, Ray is coming to my training down here in Gray, Georgia next month, and they are reaching out to those firefighters to try to get them to understand basics of, you know, Glenn, I don't know if you noticed or not, but a horse does not come with a handle. Okay, so if you're like,
I was gonna ask you about that. Dr. G, your sound is going south on us. Can you give us a call right back, and we'll see if we can get a better connection? And I'll talk to Jenna in the meantime. So, yeah, I know where she was going with that. I was thinking about that, too, as they had the rope around the horse's neck, pulling it out with a truck, trying to strangle the horse to death. But, you know, while she's giving us a call back, you know, I know where you work now is the Hooved Animal Humane Society. And I wanted to ask you, and this may sound like a silly question, but we've all seen now the Animal Planet shows about the Humane Societies and the groups like yours around the country. Is it like that? Is it? Are you dealing with that kind of thing every day, or is that trumped up? So just.
It's a little trumped up.
Okay.
It really depends on the state and your state laws. Illinois actually has a pretty good state law for animal cruelty or abuse and stuff, but you don't want to just be driving up on people's property and doing whatever you want, because as an investigator, you could get sued for trespassing or, you know, all these other things. So you don't just roll up with a trailer and go, oh, this horse is skinny, we're taking it with us.
Right.
But we have, I mean, there are some serious cases where our investigators will have to get the police involved, and we are allowed to do, in extreme circumstances, do an emergency impoundment of the animal.
Well, Glenn, so, you are aware that right now in Washington, the ASPCA and HSUS and Eric Thompson with the ERU, they are all moving out there to Washington right now. There's 63 horses that they just took in a cruelty case. So it does happen even on large scales.
You know, I have told this story before, but I have to tell it with Jenna here now, because Jennifer and I helped out years ago on one case. The Humane Society called us, and they were going to a very rural part of where we lived, and they were going to repossess. It was a couple of cows, all the animals in the house, which was a bunch of dogs and cats, and a couple of horses. And they said, this is not a pleasant situation. We need somebody to haul the horses away. And they chose us because we lived back a mile-long lane. And they said, you're going to be in a place where nobody, you could not see our farm from the road, so they couldn't see the horses. And so they chose us for that reason. And they said, this is going to be dangerous, so we're going to have state police there. So we get there, on scene, we meet at the they were arresting the guy too because he was considered armed and dangerous for something else. So we have state police. We get to the police station. We meet him there, and the head state police guy had just been moved in from Philadelphia the day before. City guy, and this is very rural. This is as country redneck as it gets. He has his shoes are spit shined. He's got his uniform pressed. He looked like he just came out of the center city, Philadelphia. And I said, you're not wearing that, are you? And he said, this is what I got. And he didn't realize this was going to be his first assignment. We get out to this farm, and the horses are in a mud pit that the mud is at least a foot deep. And so the Humane Society and the police are going into the house. The guy they thought had a gun in the window up in the second story of the house. So they were going in to secure the guy. We're standing out there. They said, hide behind the trailers. So we're waiting behind the trailers while they're trying to secure this guy with the rifle. And then the policeman says, he comes out and says, okay. And they had brought the guy out in handcuffs. And they said, okay, go in and get the horses. Well, the woman, the guy's wife, had made her way into the horse pen and was holding onto the horses for dear life by lead ropes and halters. So she's there with one horse in each hand, screaming and yelling that she's not going to let him go. And he says to me, go in and get the horses. And I'm going, oh, great, you know, because he wasn't going to get his shoes dirty. So I head in to get the horses and to take the horses from her, and she's still screaming and yelling. And I get in there and I grab the one lead rope, and the horses are being great, by the way. I grab the one lead rope, and she kicks me right in the groin, nailed me right in the groin.
Yep.
I mean, I was doubled over. She nailed me that hard right in the groin, and it was muddy, so I had a great big footprint right there. And that the cop, oh, you should have heard him. He was pissed because he had to get in there now. And boy, was he mad. He came in there and he grabbed her and drug her out of there and threw her down through the car. He was mad because he had to get his shoes dirty. And he was so mad. And then I got the horses out and we came back and got the cows and everything else. But that was my story about I never worked with the Humane Society again, by the way.
Well, that's a good story, Glenn, because you're right. That's how we used to do that, and that's how we used to do large animal rescues for the neglect skinny horse type things as well as TLR. And we've come a long way. We're far more organized these days, and the Hooved Animal Humane Society, they have got a very good team that's trained in how to try to do these things. From a legal perspective, they work with their lawyers, et cetera. And in most states, for those kind of situations, you would not be asked as just a civilian to do something like that. You would actually be part of a team that had some training and knew how to promulgate these things. But yeah, you're right, we've come a long way.
I got to tell you, that one other funny thing is he said, on the way back, you have to stop the police station because I need a picture. And he took a picture of my groin and the hoof print for the use as evidence. So that picture is now in evidence somewhere.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know what to say about that.
Wow.
Jenna, I'm sure you have a ton of stories like that, too.
It's interesting working with people because some people, really just love their animals and they don't understand, you know, why they're skinny or, you know, why can't we keep them, you know, and it's hard. And some people you can convince and just talk to and convince that they're better to give them up so we can take care of them properly. And those are, you know, there's tears and there's crying, but eventually, you know, you get to this point where everyone's focused on helping the animal, you know, and they're not so focused on themselves. But we have had a couple runs out in Ohio. You know, we called in police to go with us, and we've been met by, you know, a guy at his front gate with a shotgun saying, "You're not getting these horses."
Yeah.
And that's when you do feel like you're an animal cops because you're like, oh my gosh. you know, and you pull in the trailer and you get the horses on, and it's just crazy.
And that's the day the horse doesn't load, too, and it takes 2 hours. That's the day that happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the biggest rescue I've been on is five horses at a time, and that was hectic enough. I can't imagine some of these bigger cases.
Now, how many What percentage of the people that you deal with that you have to do repos on, what percentage of them are just naive and you really aren't getting it? And then I assume there's three categories. And then there's the ones that do get it and just aren't doing anything about it or can't, you know, then there's the ones that can't afford to do anything about it. And then there's the mentally ill one. So I assume you just see a combination of all of those.
Mm-hmm. I think the biggest amount of people I've seen are they just have fallen on hard times, so they don't have quite the money they need to upkeep the animals, but then they're all also a little maybe, I guess, naive about how much care the animals really need. You know, they'll kind of let their feet go, you know, and give them water maybe every other day type thing. So that's the biggest percentage, I'd say, is people, because of hard times, have slacked off in their care.
And you know, those people, you do have to feel. I mean, I do have some empathy for them because they didn't pick to be in that situation. That's not what they chose, you know. So.
Exactly. And you go to this training and they remind you, you know, as an investigator, like, you're going up to people's houses, knocking on their door and telling them that they're not taking care of their animals and we might have to take them. Like, that's going to be very shocking. You know, people don't want to deal with that.
Right.
So, you know, they,
but on
they
the other,
train you.
You're right. But on the other hand, we're trying to get the word out to people that this is not a dog. It's expensive to have. And it's not appropriate to just put it in your backyard and say, I'm saving it. You know, one of the things that we're pushing within the whole industry is to get more serious, like the Hooved Animal Humane Society has done. Get serious. Be a 501c3. Run it like a business. Have employees. Do it right. Because this, this crap that's been going on with many people with the salvage neglect cases is that they somehow feel like, oh, well, I bought it from the slaughter sale, and now I'm going to save it, but I'm not going to get its feet done, and I don't want to spend money on the vet bills or anything else, but I'm saving it. No, you're not saving it. What are you saving it from?
Exactly.
I have a question, Jenna. Have you guys bought some equipment to be able to deal with, like, a rescue glide or those kind of things, to try to deal with some of these situations? I'm sure that you have animals that come in that are very debilitated, and you actually have to transport them.
Mm-hmm. We actually haven't bought any equipment yet. We do have, you know, plenty of tarps and ropes and slings and stuff to work with. And we have a variety of trailers we can use that we can, like, manipulate to kind of fit whatever we need to fit inside. But, you know, we really haven't yet, which is something we, you know, need to do, because just like out in Ohio, you never think it's going to happen until it happens.
Yeah, and I will also try to put you in contact with Deep Carls so that you guys can maybe do some training with one of your local fire departments. That's one of the things we always encourage people to do, is get the fire department to come out and get a chance to just put a halter on and lead some horses that are calm and easy to handle, so that when they're in that situation, they can actually have some success. Because it's not about the people. It's more about the people than it is the animal. If you know how to handle the animal based on its behavior, it makes you more successful on scene.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, that's awesome. Well, I just wanted to thank you so much for coming on to the show this morning and talking a little bit about your experience and telling us a little bit about the Hooved Animal Humane Society up in Woodstock, Illinois. I am really appreciate your time, and I wish you lots of luck and a happy Thanksgiving. And I hope some folks will come out and either adopt a horse from you guys or send money.
Yes, that would be great. We definitely need it.
And
if you ever...
What your website is?
Yeah, go. Yeah, that was good.
Huh?
Jenna, can you go ahead and tell us the website?
Yep, it's just www.haas.org, and it's HAHS.org.
Very good.
And we have a list of all our, I think we're up to 105 animals, so they definitely have some great horses that just need to find a home.
Well, Jenna, if you guys ever need help repossessing at a farm with a guy with a gun, just give me a call. I'm experienced.
Sounds great.
I'll be right up. Thanks, Jenna.
Thank you so much.
She was fun. Sorry I took over there, Dr. G, but I had to tell it. I've told that story maybe once before, but I had to tell it again. It's just it's one of those unique stories.
No, it's actually, I actually have a video of a reporter who is actually getting beaten with a stick by a gentleman that has concerns that he was going to show pictures of the horses, and he actually beats the guy on camera. So people lose their temper and they get a little bit frantic. What looks skinny to you may not be skinny to them. And like you said, you know, in many cases, it's a mental disease as well. And, my concern is not only the animals, but there's been many, many links to the fact that animal abuse and neglect, when you start looking around, you start realizing that the children are being neglected and not fed, and the elder abuse that's happening with their mama or their daddy, that's also in the home may not be getting fed. There was a story recently over in Australia of a child that had been actually locked to the porch with a dead chicken around
the house. I saw that. Was that Australia? You know, I didn't know where that was. Was that Australia?
I think it was. Just crazy.
Well, let's get on to a happier note here. And the happier note is what's coming up as prizes on Friday's Really Bad Ads, everybody's favorite day of the week here on Horses in the Morning. So, Jennifer, they still have today yet to get the ads into Jennifer at horseradionetwork.com with Really Bad Ads in the subject line. Just go on Craigslist, go in the farm section, take you about 2 minutes to find Really Bad Ads. Send them over, and you have a chance of winning one of these great prizes.
On the prize table this week from EquityMFG.com, the Equity Flexin Fork is a premium quality manure fork built right here in the USA to last 4 years. It is the only manure fork you will find here at the Horse Radio Network Radio Ranch. The ultra-tough, distinctive yellow basket is backed up by an unprecedented 13-month warranty against tine breakage. Patented flexible backbone lever relieves stress so tines don't snap. Besides durability, customer testing shows that these forks work better, too. A larger basket, lightweight fiberglass handle, flexible backbone lever support, and ergonomic grip make picking up after your horse easier than ever. The Equity Stable Fork is the solution to all your manure cleaning needs. You can find them at EquityMFG.com. From Horse Grooming Solutions, the much sought-after horse grooming tote filled with products valued at over $100. When you need gentle, effective, economical products for your daily or show grooming needs, look no further than the Horse Grooming Solutions brands that you have come to know and love. Healthy Hair Care, voted number one horse health brand by consumers, Silverado Show Grooming, and Old Timers Equine. You can find them all at your local tack and feed suppliers, or you can go online to horsegroomingsolutions.com.
Very good. Thank you, Jennifer. Well, thank you, Dr. G, for another month joining us here on the show. We really appreciate it. And, of course, if you liked today's show, it's the first time you heard Dr. G, just go to horsesinthemorning.com, and you can find her past episodes. It's very easy. Just do a search up in the upper right-hand corner for Rebecca, and you'll pick up all of the episodes that she has hosted. I think this is the fourth one now, isn't it?
Fifth one, believe it or not.
Oh, really?
With me 5 times.
Wow. It's been a while. Time flies. Well, Dr. G, you have a terrific holiday next week, too. And one of the things I wanted to mention was in our listener earlier in the show where we read her email about her rescuing her horse, she had read your book. How can people get that? It would probably make a terrific Christmas present.
It would. Well, you can literally go to Amazon or any of the online booksellers and type in Technical Large Animal Emergency Rescue. That's the title of the book. And I wrote it with my business partner and ex-husband, as well as Kimberly May from AVMA. And I've got 6 chapter authors, and it's really the textbook that we use around the world for Technical Large Animal Emergency Rescue training. Or you can go to www.tlaer.org. and click on there's a lot of information on the website, but you can also click on the Facebook icon and get into the group page on Facebook. And there's lots of stuff that we throw around there, equipment, information, live rescues, people post pictures of what they've done. Sometimes they want to brag about what they've done. Sometimes they want to show what they've done and ask what they did right or wrong. We do all that kind of stuff. And, you know, in the end, my last thoughts for today would be, Glenn, that there's so many people that sort of, you know,
based on the themes of today's discussions, there's a game that seems to be happening here where people tell me how much they love their horse more than I. You know, I love my horse enough to put this on him. I love my horse enough to do that with him. I would never kill my horse. I would never do this or that. And I tell them, it's not a game of who loves their horse more than I do. I love my horses enough to try to figure out what I'm going to do with them, you know, if something goes wrong. I don't want to wait till a Sunday night in the middle of the night when the animal's down and I got to call a vet and have him euthanized and then try to make a stressful decision on what I'm going to do with them. If he's alive and I can find him a home, great. If he's going to die and I've got to do something with his body, then I want to find a method that's right for me today when I'm not stressed, when I'm not having to make emotional decisions. Because to me, part of loving a horse is to love them at the end as well as the beginning. You know, it's easy to love them in the beginning when you get them and it's a new relationship and it's all fun and everything else. But if you really love your horse, you need to love them at the end and do the right thing for them in the end.
Well, you just described a marriage, too, when you think about it.
I did. And actually, it's interesting that you say that, because one of my mentors and Tomas's mentors for over 50 years just died last week. And he died the way that we all want to go and we want our horses to go, which is in his sleep. So let's just pray that it'll be many years until that time for each of us and for our horses. But making that end game a positive situation for everybody is what we really want to make.
And let's next week say thank you. We have the opportunity to say thank you and appreciate what we do have now. So Thanksgiving is a week from today, and Jamie will be back here tomorrow. It's her last day before her vacation. So we'll have a show live here for you tomorrow, and we look forward to talking to you then. Thank you, Dr. G, and happy Thanksgiving to you and to your family.
Thank you very much, Glenn. Happy Thanksgiving.